Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues with the legal practice. Today, the Federal Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group is hosting a discussion by Cato Institute Senior Fellow Walter K. Olson on his latest book, Schools for Misrule, Legal Academia, and an Overlawyered America. As always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. I am David Ray, Practice Group's Associate Director for the Federal Society, and I'm pleased to welcome our podcasters, Cato Institute Senior Fellow Walter K. Olson and Mr. James A. Haynes. Mr. Haynes, who has had an active trial and appellate practice and volunteers at several Washington, D.C. area law schools judging moot court competitions, is with our Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group Executive Committee and with the leadership of our Baltimore Lawyers Chapter. I turn the program over now to Jim Haynes.
This discussion is with Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, who has recently authored a book about American legal education called Schools for Misrule, Legal Academia, and an Overlawyered America. This comes on the heels of earlier books by Mr. Olson, The Litigation Explosion, The Rule of Lawyers, The Excuse Factory, and his website, overlawyered.com. So we may assume that Mr. Olson has a point of view on these particular issues and ask, how did it come about that you wrote this particular book, Schools for Misrule?
Well, hi, Jim. As with earlier books, I think I wrote it because I expected there to be a book out there about what makes law schools the ideological dynamos that they are, and what effects has that had, and didn't see where anyone had written it, so I figured I'd write it myself.
And where does it fit in with your earlier books about the legal system and about lawyers?
When I wrote Litigation Explosion and Excuse Factory and so forth, one of the patterns that I kept noticing was that more often than not, when there would be some major new development in the courts and the law, it followed developments in legal academia. Either they had originated the ideas, or at least they had thrashed them out, and they were well known in legal academia before they made the jump to the actual courts. Certainly that's true of what happened in areas like torts and class actions. It's also true of an area like employment law. Catherine MacKinnon more or less wrote sexual harassment law from scratch, but you can find the same thing of quite a few other important areas of employment law. So the pattern again, and you know, it's not as if I was noticing this for the first time. I mean, Grant Gilmore had this famous line about what is taught by the law schools in one generation will be widely believed by the bar in the next generation. And there's a bunch of different mechanisms by which the thinking in the law school can turn into law. Often, obviously, it never does. But this is one of the important influences, and yet almost never written about systematically or at length, except perhaps in the law school literature itself.
In the process of writing the book, was there anything in particular that surprised you?
Well, a lot of things turned out somewhat differently than I had expected. I mean, I knew going in that attitudes toward the courts and litigation had changed a lot since FDR's time in particular and since the Progressive Era. And I was a little surprised by just how thoroughly they have changed. And I've got several passages about basically if you parachuted in, top lawyers from the 1930s who had, laid out the New Deal, they would more or less have found that their liberal descendants by the 1970s had reversed one position after another of theirs, especially on public law, on areas of the energy of the executive, as Terry Eastland put it in his book. And there, as I say, I knew part of that story when I went in. I was surprised to find how much more it got fleshed out in the course of researching the book.
Well, I have to confess, I have been practicing law for a few years, but I still enjoy law schools and law students, and I volunteer in moot court programs. So it comes to mind to ask you, if your book is going to be read by law students and prospective law students, what do you think they should get out of it?
You know, so much about law school ought to be inculcating a healthy skepticism. I was at a law school a week or two ago talking on the book, and someone said, you know, what we try to train attorneys for is to have a very good BS detection. I'm not sure whether he used that term.
If it fits.
And that law school still managed to accomplish a lot of that, except with regards to the BS that emanates from the professors themselves, and it's not so good at helping you to detect that. And so I think a lot of law professors would agree on that. Part of the skepticism that should be inculcated is the schemes to fix the world that are coming around the bend from within the academy. The first time you see one, it's so easy to get swept in and say, oh, you know, if only the law began doing this instead of the other way it's always been doing it, suddenly people would behave, suddenly the problems of proof and perspective and so forth would all be fixed. And by going through a long series of these efforts to save the world through law, and ones that often had enormous support in legal academia, you can get some perspective on the next one that comes along, which may not be the one that you were well prepared for otherwise.
And your book is also certainly written in such a way that it's accessible to a general audience of non-lawyers who are informed and interested about these kinds of questions. Assume that your reader is not a lawyer and is not necessarily going to read it from page one to the conclusion. What chapters or topics in particular in the book do you think would be most interesting for a general reader?
Well, it is certainly written to include a non-lawyer audience, and I'm myself not a lawyer. People inevitably, once they lose the idea they have to begin at page one, they will jump in at whatever interests them most, often through the index to see anyone they know is in it. But because it is roughly chronological or vaguely chronological, you do find that the earlier chapters treat more of the earlier legal revolutions, like what happened to tort law through the 50s and 60s and what happened to the standing and administrative law through the 70s. And that brings us to areas that are pretty contemporary. For example, those interested in environmental law will find that, as often happens, once you start talking about standing and administrative law, you are deep in the thick of how environmental law got created more or less from scratch. And likewise, some later chapters have to do with the rise of identity politics. The particular case histories that I offer are not necessarily the ones that people expect. People might be looking for a University of Michigan, how affirmative action was saved type case history. A lot of good people have written up some of those controversies resulting from the race and gender fascination of legal academia from the particularly from the 80s on. The two that I choose to write up are slavery reparations, which were the legal academy, dozens and dozens of professors contributed intellectual work and sometimes vocal support to that, and yet it fell flat on its face when it got to the actual courts, and I try to draw some lessons as to why. And a second area, very much less known about, which is the Indian land claim area, where the litigation was much more successful, although eventually in the end did not work, but certainly went a lot farther than slavery reparations. And it's not as if very many readers will actually have had contact with that in their practice, and yet as an example of something going on mostly out of the public eye, where the courts can really screw up an area terribly with all sorts of consequences for real-life property owners in the various zones that are subject to Indian claims, I find it hard to beat that one. And you know, as with a number of these stories, I wrote them up because I thought, you know, not only does it illustrate academia gone deeply seriously wrong, but there isn't a good account of it otherwise.
Now, in the book, you do have a sort of a chronological pattern that leads through from perhaps the progressive era in the early part of the 20th century up to the international rights movement, which is very much a feature of the early 21st century. Did you see any particular themes or impulses that kind of led to an evolution here, a process?
The theme of the book is to try to tease out what, if any, are the common patterns that you find in the grandiose ideas. And I think the lesson is somewhat Hayekian, because you know, you start kind of as a premise with nearly all of the ideas invite the government to do more and involve itself in areas that previously were not regulated by the government. And that, to some extent, is a left and right thing, because ideas from the left will generally involve ideas for more government, not always, but usually. And here, too, but the ideas that come from the law schools usually also involve a strong role for lawyers in litigation. They involve more legal complexity that lawyers feel capable of coping with, which the general population may not find quite as welcome. That, you know, that Richard Epstein has written so persuasively about why simple rules appeal to non-lawyers in getting through life, and
getting life.
Lawyers are always willing to add another three factors to the balancing test, and you know, add another couple of layers of due process, because it means that the legal sector becomes bigger and bigger. And in general, the law schools back that up. Their ideas are not usually for rough and ready rules that let people get by without lawyers. They are for the ever more subtlety in what the law tries to do, and an ever bigger role for the intellectuals who, you know, not only write the articles ahead of time, but part of the story is, get called in as expert witnesses, wind up because of all of the unclarities and all of the needs for the law to evolve and change as it is proved impractical. They wind up having to be called on for the continual therapy and repair.
My experience has been, and I guess continues to be, that the law begins with a client and a problem, and the client consults a lawyer with the idea of finding a solution, maybe a good one, maybe a bad one, in order to move on with life. And that that lawyers, to the extent that we serve society, do so by helping people solve their problems. And yet I get the impression of lawyers as lawgivers and oracles in your book.
Yeah, and you've put your finger on a very different approach between the practicing lawyer, who is looking for some sort of solution and knows from experience that it's probably not going to be a perfect one for the client or for society, but is looking for a workable solution. And the approach in, I'm not sure I should say typical law review article, but certainly a great many law review articles in which originality is prized, the invention of a new cause of action, even if it's very difficult to discern its boundaries or how people manage to resolve the cases raised under it, it's like the discovery of a new continent. You know, you get the credit for intellectual originality if you are the first one to think of some new way of letting the courts into an area, and it's other people. I guess Robert Bork once memorably described the it is a question of doing windows. The big thinkers come along and design the building, and then other people wind up having to clean the windows, and may have their own ironic perspective on the building's design. But if you are making your reputation through a tenure paper, then the bigger thinking you are, the better, and the more you get bogged down in details of how do we get people out of this litigation in a way that lets them get on to life, the less likely it is to be a good tenure paper.
So there is then a kind of a war in a law school, or in at least elite law schools, between the reality that the real problems of real people have an astonishing similarity over generations and centuries, and the drive, the imperative to come up with something new to say about problems that have not changed in centuries at least.
Yeah, and we're getting here into the big topic of law as an academic subject and how different it is from the scientific ones where, you know, if someone is pursuing microbiology, there is a real reason why they should go out and try to prove something that no one else has proved. In law schools, it leads to, among other things, a devaluation of some of the intellectual traits that are most useful in generating literature for practitioners. And Anthony Kahneman wrote very nicely about this, what it must be 20 years ago, in The Lost Lawyer. But, you know, judiciousness, being able to synthesize what the courts are doing without laying out some dramatically different thing that you wish they were doing, but illuminating through synthesis what the state of doctrine is or what the state of law is in some area may be tremendously important in helping along the judges, lawyers, and clients who have to cope with the law, but it is kind of devalued as a way of climbing up in the U.S. news rankings. The it's called, you know, so-called doctrinal work, and it's generally not as highly rated as it hasn't been as highly rated as theory, although they're now having a hangover from too much theory. But in general, it's not flashy enough, and you can look at similar areas. I mean, one where there's an obvious tremendous imbalance between the needs of practice and the interest of legal academia is on an area like discovery, where practicing lawyers know, depending on what particular area you're in, the great majority of time and effort and clients' money may be spent on the discovery process, and yet that process, because it is not as amenable to the tools that legal academia, you know, would like to bring to bear, like reading appellate opinions, it goes on with so much less scrutiny. I mean, you can read thousands of pages at a time of law review literature without having any feel for the role of discovery, the fact that many of the cases being talked about get resolved because of the balance of discovery costs before they ever reach the alleged rule of decision, and all of the other things. And practicing lawyers know this. You know, there is so often this disconnect. You know, that you can say the same thing about various procedural issues, although their academia is more aware that procedure is often dispositive or acts like it's aware, but still often doesn't write the articles as if it knows that.
Do you have a sense that there is a growing awareness within legal academia that the law really is not written for geniuses? The law is written to embrace the vast majority of people who have needs or do things that are wrong. And a courthouse full of average people on a Monday morning trying to learn each other's names, trying to figure out the correct room number, trial judges and their law clerks trying to figure out bail reviews or sentencing that got assigned to them that morning. It is not a process that lends itself to extended contemplation, is it? I mean, do the law schools understand this?
I mean, you raise a couple of questions. First, I mean, let me stick up for extended contemplation in that every so often extended contemplation can, you know, provide an insight that is, you know, genuinely important to the people involved with bail and sentencing and all the rest. That having been said, are things getting better or worse? Now, one of the things that I concluded in writing the book is that they are probably getting better, and people somehow seem to expect gloom and doom from someone writing from a libertarian conservative standpoint, as I generally do. But gloom and doom is not always borne out by the facts. On the issue of excessive regard for theoretical scholarship, for example, it seems to me that they hit bottom a while ago, and that for various reasons, I don't, you know, if it were a private situation, you might talk of someone doing an intervention, but, you know, people remember the famous speech that Harry Edwards gave about how unhelpful and irrelevant he found legal scholarship and the more recent comments of Dennis Jacobs of the Second Circuit about no one reading law review articles anymore. And after enough of this had gone by and various other things, including simple changes of fashion, you got a swing from some of the sterile theorizing that you had seen for a while toward more interest in real-world engagement. And certainly the last 10 years you've seen more law professors' ideas being influential again in the debate about what should happen in Congress and in Washington. You see celebrity law professors both on the right and left with policy involvement. I mean, Elizabeth Warren and Tim Wu on the left, and Randy Barnett, and various others on the other side. And the again, part of it is change of fashion. Part of it is a sense, wait a minute, we've lost a tremendously important kind of connection that once made us influential. And part of it is also even things like the rise of blogging, which have rewarded a style of legal exposition that gets to the point and is well understandable by a wide audience. And most of the figures that I just mentioned are good at that kind of thing. Some figures that I will not be cruel enough to mention from 10 or 15 years earlier were quite bad at it and would never have caught on as bloggers.
We recently, before the United States Supreme Court, had a case pertaining to matters involving a class action lawsuit, which was at least intended to embrace some 1.5 million plaintiffs by some estimates. And just on the back of an envelope, that sounds like a half of 1% of the population of the United States. Have law schools fostered the growth of class actions where the clients are unlikely to ever see, let alone speak to their attorneys?
I've got half a chapter in the book which goes into the academic background of class actions, and in particular the paper, pretty well known in its field, of course, but not known to outsiders, by Harry Calvin and Maurice Rosenfield, on laying out the rationale for modern liberal class action procedure way back in the 1940s. So it really was very prescient. And it does not... How do I put this? It does not hold up very well to scrutiny in retrospect, in that it either wrongly predicts or completely ignores what we know happened to be the enormous problems, which is lack of typicality, lack of a genuinely common grievance between all the millions of people swept in the classes, and also the problems of policing the self-dealing and loyalty of the lawyers, where it is way too easy and tempting to strike deals with the defendants that result in legal fees, but not very good relief for the class. And in retrospect, this is now clear enough in both areas that there's a pretty wide consensus, I think. Obviously, there are still some differences and some left-right differences, but there's a lot of acknowledgement by moderate liberal critics as well as by conservative and libertarian critics that these are tough problems that vitiate a lot of what was once hoped for from the class action device, certainly in the personal injury area, certainly with the skepticism from moderate judges about things like the Walmart class action and the heroic assumptions that are required in order to get past the typicality and, the commonality type issues. And so you have, on the one side, a germ of a brilliant and clever article of its day, which no one particularly contradicted, and which led over a period of a couple of decades to tremendous liberalization, a good case history of how academia influenced the development of the law. Another part of that same story, which I've written about elsewhere in The Rule of Lawyers, but not in this book, is that for a while you had a lot of serious people in academia actually proposing the kind of pie-in-the-sky class actions which would sweep in tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people. The article not actually done by academics, but taken perfectly seriously in Ralph Nader's collection on the subject, was one proposing suits on behalf of all victims of air pollution against the various industries, you know, the oil industry and the auto industry and the utility industry and so forth. And there was a time when, you know, a lot of academic effort was going into, gee, you know, how can we make the procedural rules work in order to have massive, you know, eye-popping class actions that would serve as surrogate regulatory programs. And again, that peaked quite a while ago, and there is less interest in what is, you know, looking in the rearview mirror like an obviously impractical road to have gone down.
You, to change the subject a little bit, in your book, you devote some time to the perhaps the revenge, or at least the opportunity for law students to be heard by evaluating their professors and the response of some of the legal academics to the opinions of their students. Do you hold out much hope for improved communication between students and professors?
Well, there are incentives that work in both directions on this, and I do think that law students have sometimes been unsung heroes of the tale in that they have pretty consistently wanted the type of education that gives them skills they will need for actual practice. They certainly don't object to also getting the strong philosophical grounding, and that is part of a good legal education. But when, as in examples that I quote in the book, you can get through a family law course and never be told about divorce because the professor is so interested in whatever, you know, policy or other distractions, then something has gone badly wrong on an educational level. And although schools in general do not pay attention to evaluations as far as the employment prospects of the professors, there are other ways in which they work. And in particular, every law school has the grapevine by which students advise each other, you know, wait and take this course until such a professor is teaching it and such another professor is not teaching it, or, you know, try your best to, you know, get this subject because the professor is you know, such a wonderful one, and you know, study this through bar cramming if you possibly can because the professor is so awful. What this does, you know, is not only serve as some corrective influence, but in areas like clinics, and my view of clinics is not as completely bleak as that of, you know, as some conservative commentators are. So far as I can see, the typical school will have some social activism of a generally liberal flavor going on through at least a couple of its clinics, and will also have at least a couple of clinics where that isn't the main theme. And my theory is that this is, sorts itself out in part because of student wishes, and that they can't have all activism all the time without dissatisfying students, and so they need to develop a little menu of selections so that the apolitical majority will have its you know, chance too. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't put an apolitical person into an environmental law clinic and get some activism out of it, but it means the professors are not completely in charge of running it all as a sandbox. And so you wind up with students in various ways serving as a check. Certainly, most professors buy into the ethic that it should not be about indoctrination, and I don't charge in the book that law schools are mostly about indoctrination. It, you know, what happens is through the unspoken premises and the points of view that never get represented at all, and the choice of important cases and subjects that one naturally has based on one's politics, people can get kind of a monochromatic legal education because it's so easy to go through without having a single conservative or libertarian professor, at least not an outspoken one.
I wanted to go back to the notion of clinics for a moment. I guess they have been around for about 30 years or so, maybe a little bit less. But at least at first blush, clinics seemed to offer the same sort of practical potential as the older system of legal education through clerkships with practicing attorneys, a kind of an apprenticeship idea in which the needs of the world outside law school that lawyers can do something about, those needs are balanced with the teaching and the academic challenges that should be, at least in the law school environment itself. Have clinics lived up to that potential?
I concluded, first, as you say, they were developed with one set of objectives, and their actual performance has been a success in some ways, a disappointment in other ways to their own sponsors. And one of the first things I say about clinics is that they are one of the most remarkable single-handed accomplishments of philanthropy that you can find anywhere in academia, certainly in legal academia, because the Ford Foundation came along and just through a mighty effort of will, basically, created the clinical law movement, and within a very short number of years changed it from something that had just been an exceptional experiment at a few schools to the new rule, after that it was a cleanup operation and every school was expected to have a recognizable clinical program. And one reason for this success, it wasn't just that people were interested in the more political angle of the program, which certainly for some of the advocates included taking it to the streets and having activist storefront lawyering type things. But the reason it caught on was not just that that was part of the mood of the times, but that there had been this vacuum of practical skill teaching ever since legal instruction had been wrested away from the apprenticeship methods of the 19th century and turned into a strictly academic exercise. Particularly since the trends in legal education, pressed forward by accreditation rules and so forth, had been to squeeze out the shrewd local practitioners. You know, the accreditation rules made it harder and harder to accord a central role in your teaching to the very successful local lawyer who just felt like teaching on the side. You had to have full-time professors to do more and more things. And so there was ever less of a chance for the students to get a feel for the practicalities and the practice skills and so forth that they would need. Now, clinics were not the only route that could have been taken, and nor are they still. People have suggested supervised internships with real law firms or law offices as something that schools could be doing instead that would be distinguished from apprenticeship methods by some sort of continual reporting back and structured attempt to draw conclusions in an academic setting from what was going on in one's placement. But the clinics caught on so fast because they were in part serving a gap that hadn't been met, and then after that, inevitably some of the liberal activists were disappointed that instead of changing the world, they changed the world rather
they were
less than
about
they
it.
Expected. Yeah, they
were discovering reality.
Many of the clinics were more educational and less activist than some of their backers had hoped. At the same time, the simultaneous developments in things like attorneys' fee rules developed public interest law into something that could make a lot of money for non-academic lawyers practicing it. And indeed, there came to be the question of if you had a really good public interest suit, would you be steering it toward a university clinic with all of its limitations of the academic calendar and the particular amount of effort it could devote to it, or would you rather save it for one of the freestanding environmental or civil rights or other litigation strike forces that were beginning to be incredibly successful after the attorney's fee rules had been altered in their favor. And that is also part of the story, that with public interest law having been professionalized for a lot of the highest stake things, people didn't want to turn over the many of the really juicy cases to students anymore. And so there was a tendency either to do the quixotic ones or the ones with the stakes seemed smaller.
Well, now I have a quote, which is actually reproduced in your book, which I won't ask you to identify necessarily, but it takes us to probably the last fifth or the last quarter of your book. All peoples have the right to self-determination. I find it hard to find much to quarrel with about that, at least at a high level of abstraction, but you have several quarrels and several warnings about international rights. Is that correct?
Yes, I do, and that is a quote from one of the leading international human rights documents, and like so much from the world of international human rights, it does sound completely unobjectionable so long as you hold it carefully at a high enough level of abstraction. And that, however, you know, begs the question of what happens if you try to turn it into an enforceable right through international law. And just to stick with the self-determination one, you quickly find that if the question is whether Canadians have the right of national self-determination or Quebecois have the right, or perhaps English speakers within Quebec, a yet smaller group, it's very hard to find any person who believes all three of those things simultaneously. So you wind up with victory by definition. If you want to pick which of those three levels is the nation, then you can get any of three different possible outcomes required by the right in question, if it's a right. And this certainly applies even more so to the various rights promulgated by the various treaties and conventions, some of which the U.S. has signed and ratified, others of which it does not.
Well, hasn't the United Nations, isn't the United Nations against all ideas based upon racial superiority or hatred?
So they say, and
You're not for hatred, are you?
Well, no. No one is for hatred, but again, the UN in general has taken the view that ideas, dissemination of ideas that are wrong in that area should be banned by member governments. And the United States has its First Amendment, and so the U.S. has consistently, so far, held itself aloof and always put in reservations, saying that we intend to go on respecting our First Amendment, even though it creates a right to burn religious texts and to spread racial animosity and so forth. And
don't you find the Legal Academy pretty much in support of the First Amendment in terms of writings?
I would have said yes until fairly recently. I am not so sure anymore. And let me mention a couple of the straws in the wind. Certainly, with the rise of critical race theory and the resulting interest in banning words that wound, to use their own phrasing, hate speech and the like, you got a significant debate going on the left side. This is no longer written about as much as it did, and people kind of assumed that the more libertarian liberal professors won the day. I'm not sure that it's safe to assume that for a couple of reasons. First, professors who are from the more speech-restrictive side have repeatedly chaired the I think it's the ABA section on, or ALS, I should remember better.
I'm just a lawyer, I don't know about the ABA.
But the section of professors on media and speech law, you find that all sorts of ones who take a surprisingly restrictive attitude have been winning the professional honors. And I thought it was a straw in the wind when Harvard gave the its most prestigious triennial lecture appointment to Professor Jeremy Waldron of NYU, who is known as a leading or the leading advocate of having the U.S. join Europe in allowing more speech bans of this sort. You know, it's all very high-toned, but it's also something where there would be tremendous consequences were the Waldron view to persuade liberal legal academia generally, and I am surprised by how little pushback ideas like his have gotten.
Now, it would seem that there are enormous sort of procedural and constitutional questions of converting these sentiments into laws or even into coherent ideas upon which laws could be based. What has the Legal Academy contributed in terms of not merely espousing goals, but suggesting how it is that these goals might form a constructive part of a legal system?
Well, there are a number of very important obstacles to the coordination of American law, particularly domestic law, with international norms. And there is the presumption against treaties being self-executing, for example. There are the various reservations that we have entered when we signed or ratified treaties. And there are others, too. But you will find in the literature, the large enthusiastic literature that has been generated in the law schools about this subject for the last 15 or 20 years, you will find proposals and roadmaps for vitiating many of those. The late Professor Louis Henkin of Columbia, often hailed as the Dean of International Law Studies, was also pretty forthright about wanting to knock down a couple of those traditional obstacles to the adoption of international law as being inconsistent with the undertakings that we had had newly assumed as a nation and as a court system. And again, where the academic debate is often very far. I don't want to say ahead because I don't think that it's better or forward, but it is often in a very different spot than the popular debate. The on an area like health, education, labor, welfare rights, where I think most people outside the law and the academy, or certainly most people outside the academy, generally don't think that the United States is particularly answerable to theories that there is an internationally protected right of, you know, government-provided health care, for example, or
housing, vacations.
Yeah, the housing and vacations. You know, liberal labor law. I mean, again and again and again, I've seen in this year it being asserted that Governor Walker's actions in Wisconsin violate internationally protected U.S. labor rights, even though he has really basically put Wisconsin on the same footing as numerous other U.S. states. But of course, the corollary there is that these other U.S. states are also and have been all along in violation of international labor law by not allowing broad enough unionization. And this is something where again, it's often either taken for granted or at least very widely argued in the academic literature that, yes, these things apply, we just haven't gotten to the point of letting the public know yet.
There's so it's not so much the facts as the assumptions. That.
Well, yeah, the international law is being taught as binding, being taught as extensively binding over various domestic policy issues. There is this recognition that the U.S. Supreme Court is not on board with the program at all. Indeed, despite the famous ruckus between Scalia and
Breyer.
Others, even the liberal justices have been very circumspect about not endorsing a lot of the stuff as genuinely binding. But the academic debate is in a very different place. And if you believe that eventually the one tends to catch up with the other, then either the academics are going to have to give up some very fondly held assertions about international law, or else, with new appointments on the Supreme Court or with further developments in the general debate, there will be pressure at the Supreme Court and elsewhere, too, not just the Supreme Court, to begin treating these things as binding.
Now, to shift the subject just a little bit, the Law School Admissions Council logged an 11.5% decline in law school applicants from 2010 to 2011. And I wanted to ask you to cast a longer glance, perhaps. And looking at your book, you appear to have traced about a century-long sort of trajectory of growth in elite law schools and the legal academy. With the declines in applicants, is there a sort of twilight of elite law schools, or do you see the institution continuing more or less in its present form indefinitely?
Well, the unprecedented economic reverses for the legal profession and for law schools, and no one can remember this kind of thing happening, as far as not just several years in a row in which you could not point to expanding career opportunities, but now the debate that has broken out about whether legal education is a good bet for so many people who go into it, given the enormous debts that they come out with, and the current state of the profession. This opens up the chance for rethinking along a number of different lines, and the difference between the elite and the less elite schools may not always be the affected by that, because the elite ones are very well entrenched through, we haven't talked about it, but the combination of issues having to do with ratings, with the pressure of accreditation to make everyone try to do their best imitation of Yale. Accreditation, although that too may be changing with overtures from the ABA, but accreditation has tended to stand in the way of blueprints for what could be less expensive legal education, or legal education on other than a full three-year in-classroom model. And that is obviously one of the things that could give, is people could figure out a way to make it significantly less expensive while being as attractive to employers as one or another category of existing law schools. That having been said, you see like the fictional lemmings going over the cliff. You see at least a dozen proposals to open up new law schools continuing to go forward because of the sheer momentum behind them, even as these application numbers come out.
Do you think that students may be, if you will, ahead of the curve on this, and that we may see, you know, very intelligent, very motivated students deciding to go into engineering or the sciences or other professions?
Certainly, you don't have to be a critic of lawyers and legal profession to realize that a lot of people wind up in it simply because it's a path of least resistance. They're smart. There isn't some other field that obviously draws them, and they wind up under the various pressures going to law school and becoming lawyers, even though they're interests and their personalities do not fit well into the actual jobs that they will be required to do when they come out. And everyone gains, practically, I'm not sure everyone, but certainly the applicant and many others gain when someone who would make a good engineer or a good salesperson or a good musician is allowed to do that instead. And that is something that, you know, we're not going to hear from the law schools themselves because they are selling a product. They want to get their product bought. One of the questions that is also very hard to solve is, when should someone be going to a so-called lower-ranked law school rather than a higher, that everyone's advice almost, I guess there must be exceptions, but everyone's advice is go to the highest-ranked place that takes you, which, of course, perpetuates the system, even if that place is not actually giving you a superior education, even if it's more costly. The employers will assume that you are more employable. You know, it will always help your future prospects, so go ahead and go. So long as no one is willing to break from that advice, it's actually very hard to iron out the sometimes substantial imbalances between where schools are in the rankings and where they are in the job they really do.
Now, early in your book, I mean, you talk about alternative views of law school, and you talk about it in terms of the higher education in America by Thorsten Veblen and his view of what legal education was and what lawyers should be doing. Do you now see a sort of coming full circle, some element of that, a demystification and a de-celebrity law school and legal academy?
I've been surprised by how sympathetic have been some of the opposite numbers who've come out and commented on my book at law schools. I guess I was expecting defensively there to be a, you know, how dare you say that this is about anything other than intellectual truth and duty, and yet very often there is exactly the same kind of feeling in experienced law professors that, you know, look, most of our students most of the time are going to be desperately in need of a particular set of skills in order to do their legal job well. Whatever else we're doing, we actually need to make sure that they're well equipped for handling the lives they're going to face as lawyers. And so some of the nonsense gets in the way of that. And it cuts beyond conventional left and right lines, certainly. It's something, although Veblen is not an authority that I quote very often, Veblen very pointedly saw some of the differences between the intellectual work of other disciplines where there was more of a scholarly apparatus where you could actually do hypotheses and test them, or you could be fairly sure you were advancing the state of knowledge, and what law had to offer, which was a somewhat different toolkit. And you know, very ambitious claims have been made for law over the years as something scientific, something that was just as rigorous as other disciplines in the university. But some of the divas thinkers, indeed, have been unable to stick by those pretensions and realize law is different. Law is much more important in some ways, but also less susceptible to strictly intellectual resolution.
Well, I certainly appreciate the chance to talk to you about this book. It's not often that one gets to talk to an author and find out exactly what went into a book besides what you get between the covers. But obviously you've given a lot of thought and done a lot of very original work in looking at something that is the part of the life of every lawyer. And yet, because we are so close to it, I think probably we don't think about it as much as we might. So I want to thank you, Walter Olson, for being with us. And that concludes this podcast.
Thank you both, and thank you to our audience for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.